Ireland has.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Long been accused of having an inadequate healthcare system, and now experts are warning that it's also becoming more and more inequitable. A two-tier system means private patients have shorter waiting times, more efficient care, and in some cases, access to potential life-saving drugs that are not available to public patients, at least in a timely fashion. Now, joining me to talk about all of this is Dr. Michael McCarthy, consultant medical oncologist at Galway University Hospital and secretary of the Irish Society of Medical Oncology. And also with us is Dr. Donal McLachlan Byrne, public health and paediatrics doctor, co-founder of Doctors for Universal Healthcare. Good morning and welcome to you both. We've been hearing a lot in recent days about how the health services is inequitable, that if you're private, you get treatment quicker and possibly even better treatments. But not alone that, that consultants working in the private area are more efficient than their public counterparts. Michael, can you help us to dissect that one?
Yeah, and thank you, Pat, for inviting me on. I guess that largely it's always been the case that capacity in the private sector compared to capacity in the public sector has been different. And I'm not surprised to hear that consultants working in the private sector who have much greater capacity to organise interventions, to access treatments, to organise interventional radiology procedures can work more efficiently.
I mean, do you work public and private? You do?
No, I just work just for the public. HSE.
Okay, so if you want to do a certain number or your colleagues want to do a certain number of treatments, can you kind of organise everything yourselves, or are you at the mercy of, to put it bluntly, systems?
Well, we're essentially at the mercy of systems. Now, thankfully, in my practice in Galway, I work with a great team of people who over the past couple of years have worked to implement a number of cost-neutral efficiency improvements. So, for example, on our day ward, we've managed to add 30 to 40 new treatment slots per week for patients, which means our waiting times have come down. But in terms of the treatments that we can offer patients, there is a problem in terms of disparity between access to treatments in private hospitals compared
okay.
to public
hospitals. Let's talk about, though, how you managed to add 30 to 40 extra treatment slots, because other hospitals might be listening in and they might take some of your wisdom and apply it. So what did you do?
So the main thing that has helped to increase our chair usage time is to move towards pre-assessment of patients. So previously we would see a patient on the morning of their treatment and take a blood test, assess the patient clinically, and then make their chemotherapy and then give the chemotherapy.
And is that chair kind of vacant while all of that is happening?
To a large extent, it used to be.
Okay.
But now we see the patient and do those assessments a day or two in advance. We've even started a phlebotomy service to take bloods on Sundays for patients having okay. treatments on Mondays and Tuesdays. And that means that their chemotherapy can be made in advance, so patients can come in at 8 o'clock in the morning.
And at 8:05, they're hooked up and they're having their chemo. Okay, so that's one small intervention that led to much greater efficiencies and shorter waiting times. Why did you do that? I mean, what was the impetus to get this efficiency?
Well, so all hospitals around the country are subject to national KPIs through the National Cancer Control Programme. And the KPIs are mainly...
These are key performance indicators.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so the key KPI that led to this implementation was the time to accessing treatment. So from the time that a consultant decides a patient is fit for a treatment, we have 15 working days to start that treatment. And we were falling short previously.
So people were waiting longer than might be appropriate medically.
Exactly. And now we've made great inroads in a cost-neutral basis to make that work better.
Now, was there any resistance to this? Because obviously some people have to do a little bit more work or maybe work on days when they didn't expect to be doing that work.
Well, so I must say that I expected resistance, but there was none. And that's why I say we have a fantastic team there. So the nurse managers in the day ward has been really effective in changing that pattern of work. And our phlebotomists volunteered to set up that Sunday phlebotomy clinic, okay. Again, in a cost-neutral way.
Now, is this something that is spreading throughout University Hospital Galway, that other sectors, not in oncology, for example, are saying, these people have done pretty neat work in oncology, can we find some other way in which we can improve our efficiencies?
I'm not sure, to be perfectly honest.
You'd hope so.
I hope so, probably. But it does take a lot. It does take a team to have a focused, very focused.
And oncology is a very focused discipline.
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned also how the inequity might come in is where people don't have access to the drugs that might be available to a private patient. How did that evolve?
So it's a complex issue. The first thing I would say is that the HC has made great improvements over the past 5 years. So there's been about 115 new high-cost cancer treatments approved over the past 5 years. I say high cost, this has led to an increase in expenditure. So in 2012, the HSE spent about 150 million on new cancer treatments. In 2021, this rose to 450 million. I don't have an up-to-date figure, but I would expect it's higher than 600 million at the moment. But
And some of the drugs that would be used are obviously drugs that have been there a long time, and therefore they wouldn't be escalating in costs. So the real increase is coming from the novel drugs, the new drugs.
Exactly. So if you go back 15 years, the breakthroughs in cancer treatments were rearranging the way we use chemotherapies, for example.
Yeah.
And those changes in your management could be implemented effectively at no extra cost.
So this would be based on experience with the protocols elsewhere. This works, this doesn't work. And therefore, we apply the new protocol with the same drug that has been seen to work better.
Well, all of the improvements are driven by randomized clinical trials.
Yeah.
But the thing that has changed is that drug discovery and development has been strategically outsourced to the commercial sector, and new drugs that are coming through that are the breakthrough drugs now, such as immunotherapies and tyrosine kinase inhibitors. They are high-cost drugs.
Yeah. It's not that they cost a lot. Luke O'Neill has been talking to us many times about this process. It can cost hundreds of millions to do this randomised trial, and that's right. Where the cost comes in. That's where the cost recoupment comes in, not the actual cost of putting chemicals together
exactly.
And creating a drug.
Yeah, clinical trials are heavily regulated for good reasons, and they're very expensive to run. So these days, there are fewer and fewer clinical trials using chemotherapies to improve cancer outcomes, and therefore the drugs that are coming through being shown in trials to be of benefit are these high-cost drugs, and that's likely to be the way into the future.
Yeah, and these high-cost drugs, just to give us a course of treatment of one of the novel drugs, what might it cost?
So all the prices that are charged are commercially sensitive, and nobody knows what each country pays for these drugs, but the ballpark figure might be 50 to 80,000 per patient per year on one of these treatments, which is a lot of money.
Now, how do the insurers play into all of this?
So it had been the case up until last year that in terms of the insurer's decision to reimburse cancer treatments in private hospitals, it had been the case that they reflected the HSE reimbursement status. So if the HSE had made a drug reimbursable for public patients, that's the point that the insurers would have made it available in private hospitals. But last year, the major insurance companies had pledged to make all EMA-approved cancer drugs available to private patients in private hospitals.
This is it, once they're approved for use in Europe.
Exactly. Yeah.
That they will reimburse.
Yeah. Now, I don't work in a private hospital, but from talking to colleagues, it seems that insurance companies have come through on this promise, which means that from the point the EMA approves a drug, these drugs are available to private patients in private hospitals. In the HSE, they have to go through a lengthy reimbursement process, which is obviously necessary. This is taxpayers' money we're talking about.
But it's not waiting for the cheque to be written. It's waiting for approval that you will be reimbursed should you administer this drug.
Exactly. Yeah, and hospitals are understandably very strict. If I suggest that I'm going to prescribe a high cost drug for a patient that isn't authorised by the HSE, that money will come out of the hospital budget, and that isn't sustainable.
By the way, what did you make of the report today that hospitals have not been looking for all the sums to which they're entitled from the insurance companies? I don't know whether you saw that story.
I didn't see that story.
51 million outstanding across the hospitals. I know there's only a drop in the HSE's budget, drop in the ocean really, 51 million. But still, it's a lot of oncology treatments, for example.
Yeah, I guess so. Since the new public only so-called consultant contract came in, it's been a big change in terms of what hospitals can claim, you know, whether patients who have insurance who are treated in a public hospital, what costs the hospital can reclaim. But absolutely, if they're outstanding costs, you know, we should...
They should be claimed. It may be down to an inefficiency in the bureaucracy. I'm not entirely sure. Therefore, when someone is, to use that old phrase, VHI positive, when they go looking for treatment, it will accelerate their treatment.
Not in every case, no. But in a growing number of cases for different cancer types in certain situations, it will. So now, increasingly, when I see patients, up until last year, I didn't make any distinction between patients with insurance or without insurance. But now, if somebody has insurance, I'm increasingly referring that patient to a private hospital, to another consultant, to get the standard of care, high cost.
You're doing the best for your patient. You're saying there's X drug or Y drug that will be reimbursed, which I can't do for you here, but someone in a private hospital will be able to do it.
Exactly. And essentially, I see that as my job, to identify for the patient the best possible treatment according to the evidence and international guidelines. And if I can't prescribe that here...
Okay, so in terms of, and we're going to be talking about other inequities in the system, but in terms of rectifying that inequity, what should we do?
Well, I think we have to, as a country, we have to realise that with the growth in expenditure on these high-cost drugs, we have to make tough decisions. So if we have a fixed budget for new drug reimbursements per year, we need to recognise that we won't be able to afford all of these drugs. But I think we should be more selective. We should be more judicious in which drugs we seek reimbursement for. Currently, for a drug to be reimbursed, it depends completely on the company to apply to the HSE for reimbursement. And there are about 20-30% of EMA-approved cancer drugs with clinically meaningful benefits where the companies don't apply to the HSE for reimbursement. And currently, there's no mechanism in the HSE for patients or consultants to access those drugs for reimbursement.
Now, the final element of this is scanning, and PET scans might be the most potent weapon, I suppose, in diagnostics in oncology. What about access to those kind of scans for the public patient?
There isn't enough capacity, I would say, and I think it's probably similar throughout the country.
There isn't capacity in these dedicated cancer centres.
So, in University Hospital Galway, we have put business cases in to get a PET scanner for the public hospital, but we don't have a PET scanner currently. And I think that, so we outsource to the private sector, but there isn't, even with the private capacity, with the PET scanner in Galway, there isn't enough capacity to do the PET scans that we would like to do, or that should be done according to best practice.
There's one PET scanner, is there, in Galway?
There is one PET scanner in the Galway clinic, okay, in the private sector.
So that's an issue of capacity, that even the private sector may not be able to fulfil that need.
Exactly.
Okay, I think you've outlined inequity in cancer care because, I'd been under the impression that after Michael Noonan, when he was Minister for Health, and they always have a particular focus, each Minister for Health, although it's looking at Stephen Donnelly, he has multiple focuses, I suppose. I had thought that cancer was kind of his pet project and that he'd more or less sorted it.
Well, I think, it's definitely the case that the National Cancer Control Programme has made massive improvements in how cancer is managed throughout the country. But I think this problem with drug access has emerged since then, and it's independent. It's outside the control of the current structures of the NCP, and I think that it needs more attention.
But concentrating cancer treatments in a relatively small number of centres, that worked. In terms of efficiencies, and
I think there's two distinctions. One is for cancer surgeries, which it's proven that high volume centres lead to better outcomes. For cancer, medical cancer therapies, the model of care with Sláinte Care and the OECI process for accreditation is to deliver cancer treatments safely and effectively closer to the patient.
Obviously, if you're going to be getting a chemo therapy in a chair, it's nicer to be in a chair that's only a few miles from home
rather than
travelling halfway across the country.
Yeah.
Now, Donal, you do also believe there's a two-tier health system. At which point is it most acute, do you think? Is it at primary care? You know, you go in, you pay your money, you get a doc, you get an appointment. Otherwise, you might have to wait.
Yeah. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on, Pat. I think ultimately the issue that's been described there with Dr. McCarthy and the specific example of cancer drugs, you can sort of zoom out and ultimately the problem as I see it is that in Ireland we don't have a universal healthcare system.
So just to expand on what you said there about zooming out, you could be looking at orthopaedics, for example.
Yes, it percolates across the system. To answer your question, I think it manifests in primary care, in community allied healthcare services, and in hospitals. And in plain English, what a universal healthcare system means is that it's a system in which everybody is entitled to and is guaranteed to receive the care they need when they need it without facing financial ruin. And it's important to note that this isn't a sort of utopian ideal. And actually, what we're talking about here in the Irish health system, which has just been described, that's very unusual. And Ireland is very unusual among our neighbours in not having a universal healthcare system. Almost every other country in Western Europe, almost every wealthy country in the world has universal healthcare, either through universal insurance or through tax. And we don't. And to answer your question, that in many ways is baked into the system and it manifests in lots of different ways, and such as in this upsetting example about cancer drugs. My opinion is that in some notable areas like what we've just discussed, it's to do with the actual care that is delivered. But most of the time, I feel the greatest inequities are with respect to accessing care.
And waiting times.
Yes, and waiting times. So in hospitals, that might be waiting for outpatient care. It might, as we've seen from many headlines over the years, be to do with waiting on trolleys for emergency care. Or in the community, you might have to wait for a GP appointment. Your local practice might be closed.
Are we talking really about capacity? You know, when we talk about housing.
Yeah, I think
the reason rents are high is because we don't have enough.
Yeah, partly.
If you throw more capacity, will it sort the problem?
No. So I think ultimately, as I say, a system that is not designed to deliver universal coverage is not going to reach your goal solely with resources. It's like, for me, driving a car in the wrong gear. You need resources, but you also need structure and strategy that directs you towards universal coverage. And that's why, for example, a few years ago, a few friends and colleagues and I, we set up Doctors for Universal Healthcare, which, as the name suggests, is an organisation of doctors who believe that this is something Ireland deserves and that it's something we can
deliver. Isn't Sláinte Care supposed to deliver something approaching that?
Yes, it is. So Sláinte Care is a kind of a term that most people are probably vaguely aware of, but it's ultimately was in 2017, it set out a 10-year course to chart us to universal healthcare.
3 years to go.
And we've 3 years to go, exactly. And a lot of progress has been made in some areas. So, for example, the new public-only contract that Dr. McCarthy mentioned, it looks like waiting lists have come down a little bit. There's some progress in contraceptive care for women. But ultimately, what we're talking about there with the public and private disparities, like, just to put it plainly, like, that's wrong. I think that is wrong. I think healthcare is a human right. I think everybody, whether it's a cancer or it's, you know, autism or it's an emergency that brings you to your emergency department, everybody deserves, in a decent society with the wealth that we have, everybody deserves the care they need when they need it. That ultimately is at the heart of universal healthcare. It's a conception of healthcare as a human right. And that is what should guide us.
Now, how do you get there? Because at the moment we have this two-tier system. We have the public system and we have the private insured system.
Yes.
The way some countries go, for example, in France, you go to your GP and you are insured for the bulk of it.
Yeah.
But there's a bit you throw in yourself. And that may be a controller to make sure that people just don't fetch up Yeah, that they've an itch in their nose.
Yeah.
But so you can also, by the way, you can insure for that extra bit as well.
Yeah, so those are called co-pays, and different places do it in different ways. And ultimately, I suppose, if you want to achieve universal healthcare, very broadly, you do it through one of two routes. You can do it through universal health insurance, which we looked at about 10 years ago when we didn't pursue it.
Why did we not? Because it was Netherlands model.
Yeah, there were some economic projections that showed it might have increased admin costs and, you know, without necessarily improving access. And the other main option is what's called the beverage model or a kind of tax-based model. And in my opinion, I should say, by the way, I'm only speaking for myself. These are just my opinions based on my experience. The tax-based model is the one that is by far the most feasible. Well, ultimately what you do is you invest in your publicly funded health services. You invest sustainably and strategically so that people over time do not feel the need. They don't feel the fear about, I also need to have private cover. Because we should mention, and it's often overlooked, when people are paying private health insurance, which about half of Irish people do now, we're paying for the same thing twice. Yeah. We're paying our tax, and we pay a lot of tax, and then we're also paying our private health insurance premium, which, as we saw last week,
but we are all entitled to access to a public hospital anyway. You know, that's
yes, ostensibly we are, but I think in practice, as we know, there are serious difficulties, and as I say, mostly that manifests in terms of accessing the care. I think
when you look, by the way, at the tax-based model, which means basically either your income tax or your PRSI more likely increases dramatically to cover the cost of all of this. So everyone effectively has public insurance for all medical conditions. Yeah. Have you done any estimates as to what those increases might be? Because employers would have to pay more and employees would have to pay more.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that's worth mentioning is we spend quite a lot of money on health in our country. We spend, I think the HSC budget now is about 20, 21 billion. And then that's about 80% of our total spend. And I think another approximately 20, 25% is private health insurance and also what are called out-of-pocket charges.
Yeah.
So in sum, we spend a lot on health in Ireland. And I think, you know, in many ways, our health system does a good job and I'm proud to work in it. But I think in other ways, we get a bad deal for the amount we spend on it. And a more efficient way to deploy our resources is, I think, to set out our course for universal healthcare, to spend our money in a more efficient way. And I just to mention, because we talked about GP a few minutes ago, something that a lot of people don't know about our primary care system is that Ireland is the only country in Western Europe without universal access to primary care. I think a lot of the time we focus a lot on hospitals because that's where a lot of specialist activity occurs. But Ireland, if you don't have a medical card in this society, you pay in full out of pocket to see a GP. And GPs, of course, have many of their own issues, resources and staffing, and they have requirements to meet. But we are the only people in Europe where that happens. And I think, as I say, that's a bad deal. So in most countries, I mean, don't get me wrong.
Every time we try to expand the number of people who get free GP care, whether it was originally the over 70s were going to get the GP card, and then we had more and more children being brought in, there's screaming from GPs, we can't handle it, it's too much, da-da-da.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, ultimately, like, I'm not a GP, so I won't pretend to speak for GPs, but I think that if I'm not mistaken, as of the lifetime of this government, we now have more people with medical cards and GP visit cards than don't. And I think, it's just my opinion, I think that's a good thing. I think people having access to see a primary care physician, if, for example, they have a concerning symptom, which in some cases can represent a cancer, I think GP primary care, well-resourced, sustainably funded primary care, saves lives in a preventive and cost-efficient way. So the answer is, as I say, at the very start of your interview with me, you said, is it about resources? It's about resources and reform. If you introduce reforms and don't fund them, they don't work. But also, if you just deploy resources without really zooming out and looking at where you're going, you're not going to solve your problems
either. When they do introduce reforms, they bring about, say, the opening of health centres locally, which have other things. They might have physio, they might have a number of services available. Mm. It turns out they're 9 to 5. Do you know?
Well,
and even minor injury clinics are not necessarily open at a time when they would actually staunch the flow of people into A&E.
Well, I think, to be honest, from my experience, I've worked in paediatrics for many years and we don't work 9 to 5. We work paediatricians, hospital doctors, people in all walks of the health system work 7 days a week and all the hours that are there. And I should say, you know, we talk about emergency departments. a lot of private hospital emergency departments are not open 365 days a year, 24/7.
Yeah. And that's not often visible in the fine print.
Yeah, and to be honest, I mean, now I'm sort of, this again is my opinion. A lot of the time we speak about the private system subsidizing the public system. But I think if you look at the staff in those private hospitals, they trained in public hospitals. They went to our universities. And if many of the, much of the time, the patient mix that are in our public hospitals, those are the sort of 85, 90 year old patient, gentleman or old lady with multiple medical problems and frailty and social issues and home care considerations to make. And often the patient mix that is in the private hospital where you can get through case after case after case or scans one after the other, those are by and large, I feel, more straightforward, often more elective procedures. So I think when we say one sector is more efficient than the other, it's kind of apples and oranges. So for what it's worth, from my experience working in the public system, we work 24/7 and it's always there, but not necessarily seven.
I mean, even now Bernard Gloucester is talking about the difficulty of getting rostering for Sundays, you know, that they have to, you have to talk to everybody, whether it's doctors, consultants, nurses and other ancillary medical professions.
Yeah.
You've got to negotiate with each one of them, because it strikes me that, for example, GPs, how many of them are open on a Saturday? When is the availability of people who want to see their GP most likely? Saturday or Sunday even, but that day is long gone. But a Saturday, you'd imagine, where people, you know, wanted to do their shopping on a Sunday, they got it because there was a demand. There's a demand for GP services on a Saturday. How many of them are open?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, there are out-of-hours GP practices at weekends, but I think you make a good point, which is that health and illness occurs every day of the week and our system should reflect that. What I would say is that if you try to move from a 5-day week to a 7-day week with the same number of staff, it's like spreading butter over too much bread, as the line goes in the movie. And I think ultimately, if we want to have enough staff, you need workforce planning. So like, how many nurses do we need? How many doctors do we need? How many oncologists do we need? And at a system level, that's something that maybe we haven't done enough of over the years, that idea of actually, how many doctors would we need to staff a truly seven-day service? Because I think doctors would be willing to work. We already do work many weekends and nights, and we'd be willing to do, we're flexible, as Dr. McCarthy said in his initiative in his day ward. We're very well able, I find, in the health service to adapt to new ways of doing
things. But you need to feel you're going somewhere.
You need to feel you're going somewhere. And also, you can't just do more from the same sum of people. So I think you sustainably need to invest in your people. And that goes back, it's complex. So you need to go back to your medical schools, your nursing schools. How many students are you taking in? How many occupational therapists, speech therapists, psychologists do we need? And then map it and then go for that.
Well, I think you've both educated us all this morning. Thank you very much for joining us. The voice you've just heard there is Dr. Donal McLachlan-Byrne, Public Health and Paediatrics Doctor, co-founder of Doctors for Universal Healthcare. And initially we heard from Dr. Michael McCarthy, Consultant Medical Oncologist at Galway University Hospital and Secretary of the Irish Society of Medical Oncology.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.